Okay. We'll be beginning Hebrews 5 tonight. Hebrews 5 begins really the main theological section of the book of Hebrews, which runs from Hebrews chapter 5, verse 1 through 10, verse 18. And this is what really, where the writer of Hebrews really camps out and brings out his primary theological points and his theological teaching in this section. The last time we met, we finished up chapter 4, which really concluded the exhortation section. You know, through chapter 3 and chapter 4, the writer of Hebrews was exhorting these believers to hold fast their confidence, firm to the end, to be careful not of falling into the same unbelief that the Israelites fell into, that they were to fear lest they fall, lest they while the promise remains that they come short. So there was the warnings of coming short, of failing to enter. And so it was just full of exhortation and warnings. And so when we get to verse 14 through 16, that's really the concluding section of the exhortation. But it's also an introduction to this new section because it introduces the theme that he has alluded to once before back in chapter 3, but now again, and that is Jesus as high priest, the superior high priest. Now, if you remember, the high priest acted as the intermediary between God and man. He took the people's petitions before God. He presented the sacrifice for the people to atone for the sins of the people. And so he was acted as their intermediary. And the essential attribute, if we looked over at Ezekiel 28, where the description is given, or not Ezekiel, Exodus 28, the description that's given of the garments of the high priest and what all he was supposed to wear, all this, all the dress of the high priest was really symbolic of his position and his role as the intermediary between God and his people. But the primary attribute that we see of the high priest was really engraved on the gold plate that was attached to the turban that the high priest would wear. And in Exodus 28, that inscription that was to be carved on the high priest's turban was "Holy to the Lord." This is in verse 36. "You shall also make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it like the engravings of a seal, Holy to the Lord." He was holy. He was separate. He was distinct. He was set apart for service to God. And that's what really characterized the position of the high priest. So, but the thing is, all this dress was just external. It elicited a certain amount of awe and reverence and respect from the people, but it was all external. It gave the appearance of being qualified, but it really didn't have the substance of being qualified. I mean, just think, Annas, Caiaphas, the high priest during the crucifixion of Jesus, they certainly weren't qualified as high priests. They were not holy to the Lord. They were not set aside. They were not acting in accordance with God's will. So it requires more than the right pedigree and fancy robes to qualify someone, to meet the qualifications of true ministry. And it's the same today. You know, wearing a backwards collar or all the fancy vestments and going to the right school or not the right school or being involved in a certain denomination, it can give appearance but and really just hide the reality. So the author of Hebrews here in the first 10 verses gives the qualifications of a high priest. And these qualifications still apply today. We see parallels to these qualifications in Paul's writings to Timothy and to Titus. Now, I'm just going to go ahead and read verses 5, 1 through 10. Verses 1 through 10 of chapter 5. "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. And because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so also for himself. And no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Just as he says also in another passage, "You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, there are two divisions in this paragraph. Verses 1 through 4 give us just the general qualifications of what it is to be a high priest, kind of the bare minimum standards of what it is to be the high priest, especially an earthly high priest. But then in verses 5 through 10, we see Jesus' qualifications to be the high priest. So there's those two divisions, two parts. First, the general qualifications, and then Jesus' qualifications. But there's also, within each of these two parts, there's three points of comparison that are being given. The first point is you have to have the right ability to perform the tasks. We see this in verse 1. Every high priest taken from among men, forgot to stop that clock. Every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men and things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices. So they have to have the right ability to perform the task. Then you have to have the right attitude. This is in verses 2 and 3. Then you have to have the right calling, which is in verse 4. Well, we get to the qualifications or the points of comparison in Jesus in verses 5 through 10. This order is reversed. In verse 5 through 6, we see there's the calling, the right calling. And then in verses 7 and 8, there's the right attitude, the empathy. And then in verses 9 through 10, there's the right ability. And so it's the same three points of comparison. They're just reversed in order when the author of Hebrews applies them to Jesus. But tonight, we're just going to get to go through the general qualifications, verses 1 through 4. And these were the general qualifications for the high priest under the Old Covenant. Notice verse 1 begins, "For every high priest," in other words, this is true of all who would serve God and His people. These are just the minimum, bare minimum qualifications. And to not meet one of these qualifications means you're disqualified. You're not qualified to be a high priest if you don't meet at least the bare minimum requirements. And so, the first qualification is you had to have the right ability. Well, what is this? Well, the author of Hebrews gives us two. There's two basic requirements, two basic abilities that someone who would be a high priest would have to have. Every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men. In other words, you've got to be a human. Now you say, wow, that's pretty broad. Everybody can qualify for that. Well, it's not just a matter of being human. It's the focus here is more on the commonality. Yeah, you're human. Therefore, you can be a representative of the human race. There's a commonality here. Now, it's interesting what the author of Hebrews omits here. He doesn't say you have to be a male. He doesn't say you have to be Jewish. That's because that's not his point. That's not his emphasis. His emphasis is on the commonality, being able to relate. You're taken from among men because you're appointed on behalf of men to represent men. Both of these verbs, taken and appointed, are passive. In other words, showing that this is the work of God. It's not something that is active, that somebody is doing himself. Rather, they're taken by God, they're appointed by God to this position. And it's to be, they're taken from among men, appointed as a representative of man. So they have to relate to the people. In other words, they can't be aloof. They can't stay cloistered in their study. They can't be monastic. And just think of the Jewish leaders. Did they identify with the people? No. These are the sinners. We stay away from them. We stay to ourselves. We have nothing to do with the common people out there. They were aloof. They were distant. They didn't understand the pressures of life. They didn't understand the day-to-day responsibilities that people had to deal with. They were so far removed from that, they couldn't relate to the common man. I mean, I just think of Catholic priests today who are so far removed from just the day-to-day issues of life. They just can't relate to the people. They've never been married. They don't know the struggles of marriage. They don't know what it is to have a family. They're supported by the church. They have no idea what it takes to go out and earn a living and provide for a family and the struggles and the fears and everything that we all face day in and day out. So this is one reason why I think it's really not the best idea for somebody to go straight from college to seminary to ministry. You need to bring some life experience to ministry. You need to have to be able to identify with the people that you're ministering to. And I think this is why we have this ecclesiastical corporate ladder out there so often, where somebody graduates seminary and they become a youth pastor, then a family pastor, then associate pastor, and then maybe eventually a senior pastor. They kind of climb the corporate ladder. And they have to, because they have no life experience to bring to the ministry to begin with. They say, no, you've got to be able to identify with people. You have to have a point of reference. You have to relate. You have to be connected. You have to understand the struggles and fears that people go through. So that's the first ability that somebody has to have. You've got to just be human. And the second ability is you have to function in the right sphere. So they're appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God. See, this is the sphere in which you're to operate, the high priest, and by extension, ministry today. It's in things pertaining to God. Now, you can relate to things, to people in a worldly way, or you can relate to them in a biblical way. You know, people like Mark Driscoll, the ones who want to be cool, hip, fit in with the culture, look like the culture to attract the culture. That's not being a faithful. That's not in things pertaining to God. That's in things pertaining to the world. But you have to do it in a biblical way. This is why 2 Timothy 2:4. This is why Paul gives Timothy this instruction. No soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life, so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier. And that word entangle only appears in one of the places in the New Testament, and that's in 2 Peter 2:20, about those who, once they've made a profession of faith, but then entangle themselves again in the things of the world and fall away, was better if they'd never known the truth. So that word entangle just really means to weave in. It's a weaver's term. You weave it in. In other words, you weave in the things of the world in with the things pertaining to God. That's not what you're supposed to do. You have to minister in things pertaining to God. If it doesn't pertain to God, it pertains to the world. See, the pastor's not to be a financial advisor and tell everybody how to manage their finances. Now, there's a place for that in a biblical fashion, but not in the detail that some get into. Pastor's not to be a CEO of a corporation. He's not even supposed to be a great administrator or an employer or a program developer or a visionary. No, people ask questions like, what's your vision for ministry? Well, God's given us a vision for ministry. I can't improve on that. You just implement God's vision and do that. We don't have to come up with our own. So the pastor, the high priest, the shepherd, what is he to do? He deals with things pertaining to God. He deals with truth, and he applies it to people's life. That's what should consume his life. So under the Old Covenant, things pertaining to God, what was that? Well, it's to in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. So that was the things pertaining to God, offering gifts and sacrifices for the sins. That was, but under the new covenant, we don't have to do that. Why? Well, in chapter 9, the writer of Hebrews is going to tell us that Jesus offered sacrifice once for all. It's not something that has to be repeated over and over and over again. The blood of bulls and goats can never take away sin. No, we have a better sacrifice under the new covenant. So under the new covenant, what are the things pertaining to God? What's the announcement of that in it, isn't it? It's the gospel. It's the preaching. It's telling people to repent, to trust. See, Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant. That's the purpose. That's the purpose of the divine appointment. To be involved in things pertaining to God. There's an interesting illustration of this over in Acts chapter 8. In Acts chapter 8, you know, it's the responsibility of every Christian to evangelize, right? To tell the good news, to proclaim the good news. But there's a difference between the function and the role of the person in the church versus the person that's called to be the pastor, the minister, the proclaimer, the preacher. And we see this distinction really pretty illustrated pretty well here in Acts chapter 8, verse 4. Now in Acts chapter 8, Stephen has been stoned in chapter 7, and as a result of persecution, the church in Jerusalem is scattered. And it says in verse 4, therefore those who have been scattered went about preaching the word. And in verse 5, and Philip went down to the city of Samaria, and began proclaiming Christ to them. Notice the difference between what the people were doing and what Philip was doing. The people went about preaching, Philip proclaiming. And the reason there's two different words is because two different Greek words. The word for the people, what people are doing, preaching, really would be, it really be better if they switch these words. Because the word there that the people are doing is euangelion. It's where we get our word evangelize. And it just simply means to tell good news. So this is what they were doing. They were going around telling the good news. But what Philip was doing, the word that's used there, is kerouzo. It means a proclamation, a declaration, an authoritative declaration by a herald giving the message that was given to him by his master. And he had no reason or right to deviate from the message that was given to him by his master. All he did was proclaim what was told him. And it was an authoritative declaration because of the one who gave it, the master. And so there's the difference between just the evangelizing, the obligation of everybody in the church versus the role of the preacher. He is to be doing this on behalf of men and things pertaining to God. Proclaiming authoritatively the gospel of Jesus. So that's the first general requirement is you have to have this ability. The ability to be human, the ability to function in the right sphere. The second general requirement is you have to have the right attitude. See this in verses 2 and 3. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. And because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins, as for the people, so also for himself. This word, deal gently, it's the only time... Pop a cork over there, Isaiah. this word, deal gently, is the only time that this word is used here in the entire Bible. And really it means to moderate his emotions. You moderate your emotions. In other words, it is a medium between being angry and being apathetic. Somebody comes to you, or somebody is involved, falls, stumbles into sin. What's your response? What's your reaction? Do you get upset with them? Do you get angry? Do you blow your top? Do you say, how could you do this? Shame on you. Do you condemn them? Or are you self-righteous and saying, I would never do that. And I would think, goodness, I'm not that way. I would never do that. I could never fall in that way. Or are you just indifferent, apathetic? Well, You made your bed, you lie in it. You know, you got yourself into this mess, you get yourself out. No, he's to deal gently, moderate his emotions. Otherwise, he's to be humble and gracious with the ignorant and misguided. This is what's known as a Hinnaday. Now, the word ignorant there is active. The word misguided is passive. In other words, it's their ignorance that causes them to be misguided. It leads them to go astray out of ignorance. So you have to deal gently. People who go astray out of ignorance, they just don't know better. They didn't know any better. They were never taught. Now this is just echoing the provision that's made in the Old Testament in Numbers 15. Over in Numbers 15, and it's repeated in Leviticus and Deuteronomy as well. Then Numbers 15, verse 29, God says, "You shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is not native among the sons of Israel, and for the alien who sojourns among them. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people." And this same principle is reiterated right here in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 6. How it's impossible to renew someone to repentance who has once tasted the good things and then fallen away. You know, there's been this willful, deliberate apostasy, rejection of divine things. It's repeated in chapter 10, verse 26, that if we continue to sin willfully after coming to the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. In chapter 12, verse 17. So it's the same principle. That's not what the high priest is to be gentle with, but he's to be gentle with those who are ignorantly misguided. My sister and brother-in-law, younger sister and brother-in-law, for about 5 years were missionaries in the public housing projects in San Antonio, and they lived in the public housing projects. And every summer they would do a vacation Bible school for the kids, and of course, mostly that was just a big babysitting service for the parents. And the parents took little or no interest in it, but except for that it gave them some time away from the kids. But the kids, some of it they reached. And I remember her telling me about one little girl who was about 12 years old who seemed to make a positive response to the gospel. And she started going to church, and every Sunday she would come back and say, "I just found out today it's wrong to lie. I just found out today it's wrong to steal. I just found out today it's wrong to sleep with somebody before you're married." See, just the environment in which she had grown up, none of this was abnormal. None of this was considered wrong. She was ignorant. The same thing when you're counseling people. Now, I've had to counsel people who have been involved in internet pornography, who've had husbands involved in internet pornography, and just different situations. And you can't lambast them. You can't pound them over the head with a sledgehammer. You have to shepherd them. You have to deal gently with them. Oftentimes they're just ignorant, maybe not of the Ten Commandments, but just ignorant of biblical principles. You know, they don't understand certain principles from Scripture. So people have to be taught. Now the writer of Hebrews gives us two reasons why the high priest has to have this right attitude, since he himself also is beset with weakness. So he's beset with weakness. Now, this really didn't characterize the Jewish leaders. The Jewish leaders did not consider themselves beset with weakness, did they? Just the opposite. They were holy. They were fine. They were great. They were righteous. They were self-righteous. They were in love with their self-righteousness. This word beset here is a very vivid, vivid word. It occurs five times in the New Testament and one other time in the book of Hebrews in chapter 12, verse 1, talking about the great cloud of witnesses that surrounds us. Jesus uses it in Mark chapter 9, 42 and Luke 17, 2, when he said it would be better for someone to have a millstone hung around their neck than to cause one of these little ones to stumble. To be beset with a millstone, have it hung around their neck. It was often used for putting on clothes. Now, this is a far cry from the regal robes of the high priest, right? Underneath all those regal robes, he is beset with weakness. He's human. He's prone to the same temptations, prone to the same weakness. He lives in a fallen body, has a fallen brain. Sometimes he thinks wrong thoughts. Sometimes he responds wrong. Sometimes he gets angry. Sometimes he loses his temper. You know, he's fallen. He's beset with weakness. This is why you can't be presumptuous. Oh, I can never fall into that sin. I can look at that website and that won't bother me. You're just setting yourself up for a fall. Falls happen when preparation meets opportunity. You prepare yourself, you haven't guarded yourself, preparation meets opportunity, and you fall. This is why Paul told the Thessalonians, flee immorality, right? This is why Paul gave his instructions to Timothy, 1 Timothy 6:11. Flee from these things, you man of God. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, perseverance, gentleness. Flee from this love of money. Because there's a weakness. Weakness of the body. You know, we're getting older, decaying, things don't work like they're supposed to work. There's a weakness of the mind. Sometimes you think things you shouldn't think. Sometimes you lose your temper. There's a weakness in the emotions. This is why you need to deal gently with the ignorant and misguided. Because we're prone to it all. We're prone to it all. So that's the first reason for having the right attitude. The second reason is in verse 3. Because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. As for the people, so for himself. In other words, he's in need of forgiveness. Not only is he beset with weakness, but he is in need of forgiveness. He recognizes his own sinfulness. Again, this did not characterize the Jews. Remember in John chapter 10, after Jesus has healed the man born blind, toward the end of his teaching, Jesus says in verse 39, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, that those who see may become blind. And those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, we are not blind too, are we? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains. In other words, there was absolutely no recognition of their guilt. We're fine. We're okay. Just the way we are. Now, this offering of sacrifices for sins is probably referring to the Day of Atonement, when the priest would have to kill, the high priest would have to kill a bull for himself and for his family, and offer that as a sacrifice to the atoning of his sin before he could ever enter the Holy of Holies to atone for the sins of the people. Notice here there's a divine equation. The awareness of the weakness and the awareness of sin equals what? Gentleness. Humility. This is an equation that's repeated elsewhere in Scripture. Matthew chapter 5 and the Beatitudes. The first three Beatitudes parallel this. Matthew 5:3, blessed are the poor in spirit. You're beset with weakness. You understand that there's nothing in you worth any merit. You're poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. You recognize your need for forgiveness. You mourn for your sin. You need the cleansing. Blessed are the gentle. So there's a progression even in the Beatitudes. Being poor in spirit leads to mourning, which leads to humility. This is just the opposite of the religious leadership under the Jewish nation at this time, which was pride, self-righteousness, which led to harshness and judgmentalism. No compassion. What did Jesus chastise the Pharisees for? I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Compassion. See, to not have any of this, or to be lacking any of these, disqualifies somebody for ministry. And it's such an easy trap to fall into. Especially the last one, to become harsh. Especially as we grow in our sanctification, to look at others that maybe aren't as far along as we are and have somewhat of a condemning attitude. This is why Paul had to tell Titus, because he knew it was a temptation. He knew that this was something that was so easily to fall into. Titus chapter 3, verse 1, remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be uncontentious, gentle, showing every consideration for all men. For we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. But when the kindness of God our Savior and His love for mankind appeared, He saved us. See, it's because we were this way. We were like this. Therefore, we should be gentle. We should understand where people are coming from and being able to deal gently and kindly with them. That's just true of all Christians, but it's especially true of one who would shepherd God's flock. Well, the only way to keep this right attitude alive is to see ourselves as God sees us. And how do we do that? We'll look at the cross. See, this is where the cross has been so perverted within Christianity today. Today, the cross is held up as proof positive of our ultimate worth. See how valuable you are. See how magnificent, how much you're worth. Look what God did for you. You must be worth so much. That is such a perversion, man-centered, self-exalting view of the cross. The cross is evidence. That's how bad we are. That's what it took for God to redeem us. So if you want to have the right attitude, look at the cross. Examine our motives. Measure ourselves against the divine standard. Read Matthew 5 and how Jesus explains the law and see how we measure up. So anyone who can look on a sacrifice, the sacrifice of Christ, with a sense of pride and self-satisfaction, they just don't have Christ. They just don't have it. They don't understand. They've never gotten it. So you have to have the right ability. You have to have the right attitude. And then there's a third point of comparison here in verse 4. You have to have the right calling. You have to have the right calling. He tells us how one is called. No one takes the honor to himself. He receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was. This is how someone has to be called to ministry. So the first is a negative. No one takes the honor to himself. In other words, you're not self-called. Anybody that goes to ministry can't be self-called. They can't just wake up one morning and say, well, I think I'll go into ministry today. I've known people who've done that. Can't be appointed by men. It's not just arbitrary. It's not just carrying on a family tradition because my dad was a preacher and my granddad was a preacher, so I'm going to be a preacher. That's not the way it's done. It's not an emotional reaction. Many people go into ministry because they think it's an easy life. You know, especially get into denominationalism. Hey, this church doesn't work out. They'll just move me to another one. MacArthur told of a pastor he met who said he never spent more than 2 years in any church. He had 52 sermons, he preached each one twice, and after that he was gone. On to another church. Well, you never have to build a ministry, you never have to do anything. No, you have to prepare sermons, they're all 52 prepared already. It's this easy life. Or sometimes people go into ministry because they desire a following. They want a ministry, they want a following. They want to attract a crowd. So no one takes the honor to himself. And then he gives us the positive, but receives it when he's called by God. As Aaron. Aaron was called by God. He was appointed by God, Moses' brother, and appointed as the high priest. You see, you're called by God. It's not a career. It's a calling. There's no retirement from a calling like there is from a career. Pastors retire all the time. Now, sometimes there's legitimate reasons. They have health issues. Maybe their wife has a health issue. There's family pressures. There's legitimate reasons why a man needs to step down from the pulpit. But when his health is good, his family's health is good, there's everything's fine, and he gets 65 and retires, he had a career, not a calling. You know what John Bunyan's response to the call was? You ever read any of the stories of the history of John Bunyan? When John Bunyan realized he was called to the ministry, that he was called to preach, he was devastated. He was terrified. He begged God not to call him, not to put him in that position. And when he was jailed, he preached from inside the prison. He would stand in the courtyard of the prison and preach over the wall to people who would stand outside until they finally quit letting him go out in the courtyard and made him stay in his jail cell. He was called to preach, and he was going to preach even if he preached to four walls. How do you know? How does somebody know if they're called by God to be in the ministry? Well, it's somewhat subjective, but it's also somewhat objective. And I just want to read something here from Martin Lloyd-Jones. I mean, the first time I read this, I felt like I was reading my life history. But Martin Lloyd-Jones, in his book called Preaching to Preachers, says, let us first look at it in terms of this question of a call. What is the preacher? Well, obviously, the preacher is a Christian, like every other Christian. That is basic and an absolute essential. But he is something more than that. There is something further. And this is where this whole question of a call comes in. A preacher is not a Christian who decides to preach. He does not just decide to do it. He does not even decide to take up preaching as a calling. Now, that has often happened. There have been men who have rather liked the idea of being a minister. It seems to be an ideal type of life, a life with a fair amount of leisure, giving ample opportunity for reading philosophy, theology, or anything they may want to read. If they happen to be poets, well, it's something that will give them ample time to write poetry. The same applies to essayists or novelists. This picture of the type of life lived by the minister has often appealed to young men. And there have been many who have gone into the ministry in that way. I need scarcely say that this is entirely wrong and quite foreign to the picture one gets in the Scripture, and also as one reads the lives of the great preachers throughout the centuries. The answer to that false view is that preaching is never something that a man decides to do. What happens, rather, is that he becomes conscious of a call. This whole question of the call is not an easy matter. And all ministers have struggled with it because it is so vitally important for us. Am I called to be a preacher or not? How do I know? I suggest that there are certain tests. A call generally starts in the form of a consciousness within one's own spirit, an awareness of a kind of pressure being brought to bear upon one's spirit, some disturbance in the realm of the spirit. Then that your mind is being directed to the whole question of preaching. You have not thought of it deliberately. You have not sat down in cold blood to consider possibilities and then, having looked at several, have decided to take this up. It is not that. This is something that happens to you. It is God dealing with you and God acting upon you by His Spirit. It is something you become aware of rather than what you do. It is thrust upon you, it is presented to you, and almost forced upon you constantly in this way. Then what has been happening in the realm of your spirit in that way is confirmed are accentuated through the influence of others who may talk to you and put questions to you. Then, this develops and leads to a concern about others. I'm contrasting this with the far too common idea of entering the ministry as taking up a profession or a calling. The true call always includes a concern about others, an interest in them, a realization of their lost estate and condition, and the desire to do something about them, and to tell them the message and point them in the way of salvation. This is an essential part of the call, and it is important. It has often happened that young men with certain gifts who listen to a great preacher are captivated by him and what he is doing. They're captivated by his personality, by his eloquence, they're moved by him, and unconsciously they begin to feel a desire to be like him and do what he's doing. Now that may be right or it might be quite wrong. They may only be fascinated by the glamour of preaching and attracted by the idea of addressing audiences and influencing them. All kinds of wrong and false motives may insinuate themselves. The way to check oneself against such a danger is to ask oneself the question, why do I want to do this? Why am I concerned about this? But we must go on to something yet deeper. There should also be a sense of constraint. This is surely the most crucial test. It means that you have the feeling that you can do nothing else. It was Mr. Spurgeon, I believe, who used to say to young men, if you can do anything else, do it. If you can stay out of the ministry, stay out of the ministry. I would certainly say that without any hesitation whatsoever, I would say that the only man that was called to preach is a man who cannot do anything else in the sense that he is not satisfied with anything else. This call to preach is so put upon him and such pressure comes to bear upon him that he says, I can do nothing else. I must preach. Well, let me put it like this, and I'm speaking from personal experience. If you are certain of it, you are certain of the call, when you are unable to keep it back and to resist it, you try your utmost to do so. You say, no, I shall go on with what I'm doing. I'm able to do it, and it is a good work. You do your utmost to push back and to rid yourself of this disturbance in your spirit, which comes in these various ways. But you reach the point when you cannot do so any longer, and almost becomes an obsession. And so overwhelming that in the end you say, I can do nothing else. I cannot resist any longer. And he says, realizing that this is what is involved in preaching, it is inevitable that a man should feel unworthy and inadequate. And so that's how he describes the call. It's called by God. It's not just, I want to be like that guy. I want to draw a crowd like him. I remember Vody Bachum saying one time that he had a young seminary student come up to him and say, I want to do what you do. I want to be like you. I want to have a ministry like you have. And Vody was just saying, you don't understand. You understand it at all. I didn't do this. God did it. He's used me. I didn't create this. God did it. So here we see the general qualifications for the high priest. And by extension, the same principles apply today. You have to have the right ability, the right attitude, the right calling. You're called to serve, to represent God to man and man to God. And next week we're going to look at how these compare with the eternal high priest, with Jesus. And this is where the author of Hebrews first introduces the priesthood of Melchizedek. Remember, Aaron was in the, or there was the Levitical priesthood. There was the priesthood of Melchizedek, not in the line of Aaron. And this is what we're introduced to next week.